This is Can I Laugh on Your Shoulder? Hey, welcome to Can I Laugh on Your Shoulder? I'm Molly Stillman, and this is a podcast where I get to sit down each week with a different guest, and we have raw, funny, often brutally honest conversations about the things that matter most. Faith, business, life, and everything in between, where we each learn how to be good stewards of the things we've been entrusted with, even our stories, and how we can use those things to serve others and leave our families, our friendships, and our communities a little better than we found them. I want to create a space where people are unafraid to be themselves and unafraid to ask the questions the rest of us are thinking. My goal is to make you laugh, cry, and laugh till you cry. My guest this week is the most special guest that has ever been on this show, and that is my dad. Yes, my guest this week is my dad, Tom Buckley, and I had him on for a very special reason, and that is because next week, as of when this airs, next week, my book, If I Don't Laugh, I'll Cry, it's right there behind me if you're watching the video, but If I Don't Laugh, I'll Cry, How Death, Debt, and Comedy Led to a Life of Faith, Farming, and Forgetting What I Came Into This Room For, releases into the world. Yes, my book releases next week, and I wanted to have my dad on because he got to read it, and I wanted to just introduce you to him, but he and I dig into some stories that we talk about, that I talk about in the book, and some stories that aren't talked about in the book, and we really dive deep. We laughed. I just had a really beautiful conversation, and also, my dad is the best, and so I know that you're going to love him. I know you're going to love this conversation, and also, while I am on the topic of my book, like, we're less than a week out. I cannot believe it. So would you do me a huge favor? Would you go to your favorite retailer where you buy books, whether it's Target, Walmart, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or my choice that I prefer is at your local bookstore, and would you pre-order the book? Pre-ordering the book is a huge, huge, huge help. I would be so honored if you would do it. And if you have a local bookstore near you, if you would ask if they would carry it, that would just be amazing. This is something that I have worked on for years and years and years. And so here I am, essentially just cashing in my chips. And I'm like, would you please buy my book? but not just because I want you to buy my book, but also because I genuinely can't wait for you to read it. And I know that you are going to laugh, you are going to cry, and you are going to laugh till you cry. But without further ado, it is now time to get to my conversation with my dad, Tom Buckley. Well, this is probably the most special episode of my podcast that I have ever done and ever will do because my dad is my guest today. Dad, thanks for being on my podcast.
Hey, thanks. What number am I?
You're going to be like almost episode 390. You're like 388, 389.
Oh, I want a shirt that says almost episode 390.
Hey, almost 10 years till you're 90.
That's about, oh, yeah.
That's all right. We won't talk about that. Okay. Well, Dad, this is a really big day. I've wanted to have you as a guest on my podcast, really just to, honestly, I've debated starting a podcast just so that you could tell stories, so that we could like house them in the internet sphere for eternity. But this is the next best thing. So, but you know, I have to treat you like a real guest, Dad. And so you have to give us the Tom Buckley 101, the pop pop 101. So tell us who you are, what you do, and how you got to where you are today.
Well, I was born a poor white child. So I'm just...
Oh my gosh.
Who I am? Well, you know, I'm your dad. I'm your dad. How did I get there? Boy, I'll tell you, that road was not paved with smooth asphalt, I can tell you that. I don't know. It's just, it's amazing that I look back and there isn't anything in my life I would change because everything, every wrong thing I did got me to where I am right now. But, you know, I don't know, I did the typical thing, you know, I was okay in school. I didn't particularly care for school, but I did what I had to do, played some sports, stuff like that. but started working young, 13 full-time job. Prior to that, a paper route. But I don't know. Looking back, I don't particularly appreciate that part. That's why I didn't want you or Bridget working. I wanted you to be able to participate in, you know, school activities and that kind of thing. I gave up a lot of stuff. I gave up playing a musical instrument and playing some sports and stuff, and that's okay, but that was the times. You know, I was raised by parents who were coming out of the war. My dad always worked two jobs. My mom was a homemaker with five kids and worked all the time, and work was a thing. Work ethic was a big deal. So when my dad got me a job at the Putin newspaper where he worked, I was supposed to do that, and I did. The trouble is, I had this side of me that was rather recalcitrant. I can't spell that, but that's what I was. And I had, I just had this thing in me that if you said don't do that, I would do it, no matter what it was. And I had a BS tolerance of about that long, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't know where that comes from, but that's what I had. And, you know, I grew up in a religious education, and I knew from second grade on that I was reading something wrong. My dad was Catholic. My mom was Methodist. And when I was in grade school, I was considered from a mixed marriage. Oh, my God. A mixed marriage. And my mom was a saint, but according to the church, she wasn't going to go to heaven. And I thought, well, okay, so I'm missing something there. So I kind of poo-pooed any kind of religion or relationship with God or any of that kind of thing right from the get-go. So I had no real foundation for anything. When I was 13 as an altar boy, you were mentioning this in your book, I had my first drunk over resentment.
Well, you should tell the story, and you can just say, I do tell it in the book, but it's better coming from you, so you can tell your version of the story.
Well, first of all, in fifth grade, I was in choir, and Sister Mary Jude Thaddeus kicked me out of choir and said I couldn't sing, and that really stays with me to this day. I would never karaoke because of what Sister Mary Jude Thaddeus says. Now, I'll sing in the shower. The shower loves my voice. But I'll sing in front of Cindy, but there's no way I'd do karaoke. And I blame that on Sister Mary Jude Thaddeus. She said I couldn't sing. I probably can't, but I don't know. I never tried because of that. So that kind of scarred me. Oh, my God. Anyway.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, okay, I'll become an altar boy. And they had this hierarchy of altar boys. You started out as a page, then you became, I don't know, something else, then a knight, and then anyway. When you got to the top, I forgot what the head altar boy thing was. I don't know, King Arthur or some friggin' thing. But I was at the top in eighth grade. Richard Meshaga and I, we were the top two altar boys. So we got to do the good stuff. We got to serve the weddings and the funerals and the high masses and, you know, do all the fancy stuff for the Monsignor and do all that kind of stuff. So that was kind of cool. But anyway, this one time we were pulled out of class in eighth grade to serve what I believe in memory is an actual funeral because weddings weren't held during the week. And after the service, we were in the sacristy cleaning up, and the gentleman from the congregation came in and gave us each $10. This was like gold. I mean, yeah. I'm having a paper route where I'm making 2 cents a paper. So 10 bucks was a lot of money.
Yeah.
And we were thrilled. Well, as we're cleaning up, Sister Mary Virginette, and that's a real name, by the way. She was a tiny little virgin. Sister Mary Virginette came in. She was also my seventh grade teacher when I was in seventh grade. But she was the seventh grade teacher. She also in charge of the altar boys. And she came in to see that we were doing our job to check on us. And we said, hey, sister, guess what? We each got $10 from a man in the congregation for serving this mass. Isn't that awesome? She said, yeah. And she took the 10 bucks each from us. We're dumbfounded. She came back a little while later and gave us each a buck. Well, when she left, I turned to Richard and I said, this isn't going to fly. This is just wrong. This is just plain wrong.
Yeah.
So here's what we're going to do. Monsignor has a brand new bottle. Monsignor Ferrari had his own special wine. I don't know what it was, but it was his wine. It was only used for his masses. and he had a brand new bottle unopened, and there was a cookie tin full of unblessed hosts. I said, we're going to have a wine and eat some hosts to celebrate what we did, and the heck with Miss Sister Mary Virginette. Well, we wound up killing that whole bottle of wine and eating those hosts. And by the time we got back to class early afternoon, we were hammered. Richard and I were, we're 13 years old. We're buzzed. We are toast. And we're in the back of the room cutting up, giggling, making cracks. And Sister Mary Georgine, who was a teacher, was sitting up at her desk with her cane. She was sitting down. She couldn't stand up. I think she was 180 years old. And she would tap on the floor and bang it, call us wiseacres and things like that. Well, needless to say, I got in a little bit of trouble for that. But it was worth it. That's the thing that looking back, that was somewhere in my psyche that didn't make any sense. The punishment I got from that was totally worth the experience. Totally worth it. So I had my first drunk over a resentment at 13. Yeah. Well, by the time I got to 15, I'm working downtown at the Plain Dealer, and I'm working with college boys and adults, and I'm learning how to smoke cigarettes, and after work going next door to the Headliner, where they didn't care about your age, I'm learning how to drink, and I'm learning how to be an adult at 15 years old. Well, yeah. Nothing about being an adult, really, but that's what I thought I was doing, and I was off and running. It was all about having a drink and having a good time after that. Went to college, didn't want to go to college. My dad made me go to college. I wanted to enlist. Told me I wasn't going to do that. Went off to college that summer, and that fall then joined a fraternity because I had friends from high school and friends. In fact, one, Bob, who you know, Bob Fettig.
Yeah.
He was, I was altar boys with him.
Yeah.
I'll tell you a Bob Fettig story with that. When I left eighth grade, I went to public high school, partly because of the punishment that I received from the drink. But anyway, I went to high school because I lived right behind the Brush High School. But I continued to serve. But I served the 6 o'clock morning Sunday mass by myself in the basement. They ran two masses, one upstairs, one downstairs, in downstairs chapel. And I served that one because my dad took me every Sunday. And I served that one by myself, with two altar boys up in the main church. The reason I served it by myself is because the fourth altar boy never showed up. Well, a year and a half into this, I come to mass one day, and I'm met by a different nun. It wasn't Sister Mary Virginette, then I forgot who it was, to be honest with you. But told me I was no longer an altar boy. I was kicked off altar boys. I'm with my dad. And I said, why? Well, you haven't been showing up. I said, what are you talking about? My dad's bringing me. I'm serving this mass by myself because this other, whoever that is supposed to be there, isn't there. No, you're not showing up. You're out. Well, my dad, he went to the Holy Name Society. He went to everybody. Never got me back on being an altar boy. That further soured my opinion of things. Well, the boy that never showed up was Bob Fettig.
of course.
We were classmates at St. Gregory. We were classmates in Brush High School. Well, guess whose fraternity I joined? The one he was in.
Bob's.
So, yeah, Bob. I mean, we had been friends for a long time, and we laughed a lot about that after that. But, yeah, he was the one not showing up. Go figure. Anyway, I had a great fraternity experience. I remember you called me from CNU, and it was interesting. When I dropped you off at CNU that first day, I remember sitting in the car thinking to myself, I had a tear in my eye. I didn't know which way you were going to go. I know you were dealing with some depression over Mom, some uncertainties and other things. And I wasn't sure what was going to happen. But I had to let you go. I had to let you now start with life's experience. And it was shortly thereafter, I want to say maybe a month, something like that, whatever. You called me and said, Dad, I'm thinking about joining a sorority. What do you think about that? And I remember saying to you, it was the best decision I ever did in college. It's the one thing I would do over again.
Yeah.
It gave me a sense of community. It gave me a sense of belonging, all that. I enjoyed my fraternity experience completely.
Yeah.
I didn't take school serious enough. I mean, I did enough to get by. I did enough to graduate and all that. But I worked for 4 years. and enjoyed the fraternity social life. And all that did was breed really irresponsibility in me. After that, I wound up getting married because I guess that's the thing you had to do. I don't know. I don't, looking back, I shouldn't have.
What year did you graduate? You graduated in 60 what?
Class of 66.
Okay, that's right.
Yeah. And I turned 22 that June, 66, and married in middle of June of 66. My mom died August 1st of 66. That was tough. My mom was bedridden at the time with a cancer, and I remember bringing the wedding party by for her to meet them, and they left the room, and I had some time alone with her. And the only real piece of advice I had in my whole life from my parents that I look back and really I should have paid attention to was my mom at that moment. She's on her deathbed. She had just met the wedding party. I just left the room, and she looked at me and she says, "Tommy, you don't have to get married." Mm-hmm. That's a quote. And I didn't know what to do with that. Went through with it anyway. It didn't work out. Long story short, you talk about that in your book, and it's all accurate. But anyway, it was an experience. Anyway, I started teaching inner city of Cleveland, then out in a suburb, an integrated suburb of Cleveland, and had a good experience there. Trouble was, I still had that thing inside of me, that recalcitrant gene inside of me. And it was a period of time in the late 60s, early 70s of teacher unrest. We had a superintendent. I was president of the teacher association there. And we had a superintendent who was all about getting grant money and nothing about sound.
Was this
education
in Cleveland? I don't know if I ever asked that.
This was actually, I started in downtown Cleveland, and I got jumped there. I had three guys on parole come in my class and demand something, and I wouldn't do it. And I got jumped, so I had enough of that place. So I went out to Warrensville Heights, which is a suburb of Cleveland, but it's an integrated. Or the Warrensville Heights High School. But anyway, as president of the state teachers union, I was a head negotiator too, so contract negotiations. Our agendas, the main items of our agenda were curriculum related. We wanted teacher voices in curriculum development, things like that. And he was all about getting grants for stuff that didn't mean anything, one of which was a humanities grant, where you would teach English and social studies and history all under one umbrella. So I'm teaching classes of all boys who can't fill out a job application. Follow me? I'm getting called in front of the school board for teaching grammar by using diagrams on the sentence, on the blackboard, because these kids, they didn't have any of those skills. And to run by them intricate poetry and analysis of history and things like that was far beyond their capability. Not to put them down, but they just weren't able to do that at that point. They needed development. So we butted heads big time. Butted heads so much that in my final year there, I had somebody in my class monitoring my class every day, every class. I was recorded on the PA system every day, every class. It got to be pretty tense. And come the end of the year, when they renewed contracts, they didn't renew mine. They didn't fire me, but they didn't renew the contract. They couldn't fire me. There was nothing to fire me for. But that summer, in the August board meeting, was the last opportunity to renew a teacher's contract. The only thing on the agenda was my contract. Well, the board meeting was filled. It must have been 500 people in that gymnasium, because they had to hold the board meeting there. And they renewed my contract. There had been a lot of protests on both sides leading up to this. It was a really tumultuous period. But anyway, they renewed my contract. But then they assigned me to the junior high, teaching a course that I wasn't certified to teach, with a full load with only a 20-minute lunch break. Well, I saw the handwriting on the wall after the year I'd just been through. So I resigned, and I took a job in the private sector. I was offered a couple jobs that I turned down, but anyway, it's beside the point. And from there, I married your sister's mom, because we were teachers together. She was secretary of the union. We became good drinking buddies, and she got pregnant. So I married her. And that's a fact. Looking back, I'm glad it happened because I've got Bridget, your sister. She's the best. It was tough, though, because we weren't meant for each other. And yeah. It was a lot of years of fighting and just bad vibes in the house. And there came a time where she just said, you got to leave. And I did. And I really thought about that because, well, maybe I'll try to work this thing out. But my drinking got bad. And, you know, I wasn't present most of the time. And I thought, if I stay, it's not going to be good for Bridget because the environment was just too awful. So I left. And that just put me homeless for a year. I didn't know where I was going to go. I had a trash bag full of stuff. And just bounced around. Slept where I could. Did what I had to do to survive. Not a lot of things I'm proud of. And didn't know how that was going to change. Didn't know how one day was going to be different than the day before. Each day began with a full of resentment and regret and ended with a feeling of impending doom. And every day was like that. Didn't know how to get out of it.
You were sleeping in your car and on park benches and...
Yeah. Yeah. And it gets cold.
Yeah.
It gets cold. Remember having dirty clothes as a pillow. I had this car, if you want to call it that. It was a 72 Gremlin. A Gremlin was a good name for it. It was like a baby poop green, full of windows, and had one seat, a driver's seat. That was it. Four bald tires. But it had plenty of room to stretch out in the back. Anyway, then a change came in my life. I got a couple of bucks together. I got a motel room in Richmond. And for some reason, I decided I'm going to call Bridget's mom and see if I can see Bridget. Now, she hadn't seen me in a year. Nobody knew where I was. My family didn't know where I was. What was going on? Nothing like that. I'd been up to Ohio for my dad's retirement because my sister sent me some airline tickets. But for that brief stint, which involved a lot of drinking, that was about it. Nobody really knew what was going on with me. Anyway, for some reason, Bridget's mom said I could come get her. And I drove up and I got her. And first stop we made was the American Legion Hall because I could buy cheap beer and she could put nickels in the pinball machine and I could spend quality time with her. And then the next thing I knew was 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm coming to in this motel room. She's laying next to me. I had no idea how I had no recollection of making that 100-mile trip back to the motel. And I'm screaming to God, help me. I'm screaming, God, please take this from me. I can't do this anymore. And I got snot coming out of my nose and I'm crying and I'm scared as hell. And that was the miracle. That's the moment that I had a spiritual experience. That's the moment God entered my life for real this time. And I began to develop a relationship. And I had in my wallet at the time, which I'm surprised even had a wallet, I had a business card of a ASAP Council, that's Alcohol Safety Action Program of City of Alexandria. Her name was Norma Leeward. And I had her card and it said something about alcohol on it. And I thought, well, maybe she knows how I can, what to do next. I had no idea what to do next. At 3 o'clock in the morning was a Sunday. I spent all day standing in the pool while Bridget played in the pool because I was shaken going through withdrawals. And I took her back home the next day and then went to see this Norma Leeward. And I walked in the office and I said to the lady, I said, I want to see Miss Leeward. He said, what is your name? I said, Tom Buckley. And I heard a voice from the back office yelling, oh my God, where have you been? And I went back in this woman's office and she said, we've been looking for you. I said, I don't even know you. Well, it turns out I got a card because I got a DUI back the year previous February, was put in jail. When they release you from jail through the magistrate, they assign you an ASAP counselor. And you're supposed to go to this ASAP counseling and then go to court. I don't remember any of that. It was all in a blackout. I have no recollection of any of that. So that's how I wound up with a card. Well, she took me to an AA club in Alexandria, the Wilson Club, and the rest is history. The rest is history. And I hear I sit today.
And you've got 45 years now, almost?
It'll be 45 in July, but right now I got 44 some days, yeah. I got today is what I got.
Yeah.
I got today. And the only reason I got that is I didn't die and I didn't drink. That's the only reason, you know, but God has been in my life since then. It's been a journey. It's not that I, you know, knew everything from the start. I had to develop my own relationship, but then that took time. But I allowed it to happen. That's the key. I allowed it to happen. I was open-minded and willing and didn't want to go back to where I was. And what I've learned is we have a saying in AA called let God, let go and let God. And to me, all that means is I have a responsibility to do where my feet are, to take care of where I am at this moment, take care of the responsibility I have with whom, what I'm doing, whatever the case may be now, and do that. If it's take the trash out on time, it's to do the dishes, whatever it may be. There's nothing complicated about it. And if I do that, then life will work out for me. And that's exactly what's happened. When I get out of my own way, when I want to plan on how much many fish I'm going to catch in a fishing trip, I'm in trouble. But if I just plan the trip and go, it works out really well. So here I am. I'm now on a podcast with my daughter. Thanks for the dedication, by the way. Appreciate that.
You're welcome. And,
you know, I'm so proud of you. I can't tell you. I'm just so proud of you. This book, it's amazing. Your mom wrote a book that exorcised Vietnam from her, and now you've written this book, which is exorcised, if I can say it that. A lot of things from your life. But it's brave. It was very brave. Opening yourself and being vulnerable like that, this is going to help a lot of people. Going to help a lot of people. I couldn't be more proud of you.
Thanks, Dad. Well, I was the most, I mean, I told you this, but I was the most nervous for you to read it. Because obviously, I mean, you and I had a lot of conversations over the last 2 years as I was writing it, just kind of cross-referencing our own memories from various experiences. Because, you know, everybody experiences events in their lives from their perspective. And so, you know, what I remember might be different than what you remember. And so it was like, it was important to me to write it from what I experienced and what I remember, but also just cross-referencing to me, like, was I way off here? You know what I mean? But then I also was fully aware that there was a lot in the book that I wrote and shared that I hadn't necessarily had conversations with you about. And it's interesting now as a parent myself to watch as my kids grow up, watch them make mistakes and to know things that are going on, even though they don't tell me and things like that. And so it's interesting to like look back and be like, what did you know?
I know.
But it's, you know, when you're a kid and you think that like, oh, like my parents don't know, my parents have no idea. And then you look back and you're like, oh, they probably had a whole lot more of an idea than I think they did. But that was, I mean, I was, you know, I've had the benefit now of looking back and cataloging all of those things. And I knew that there were parts that we hadn't necessarily had conversations about or were, you know, for me to ask you, like, did you know that that was going on? And anyway, so I think all of that just played into, I was really scared for you to read it because I was like, this is going to go one of two ways. Like, he's going to love it or he's going to never talk to me again. Not that I think you would ever not talk to me again, but for some reason, I was just like, I had this fear in the back of my mind.
What, there isn't anything you could possibly do for me to never talk to you again.
I know. No. I'm just telling you that this is my own personal neurosis.
I might give it that. I might give it that, or I might roll my eyes, but I would never not talk to you again.
I know. But it was my own. It was my own. Like, is he going to be mad at me? Like, you know, I don't know. It's the typical father child thing where you're just like, did I do this wrong? Like, I'm afraid of still getting in trouble at 38. But anyway, when you sent me a message that you'd finished it and that you loved it, that was needless to say, I breathed a sigh of relief.
Well, it was a quick read for me. I couldn't put it down. But it was a hard read. I had to take a couple of tear breaks, to be honest with you, reliving some of that stuff.
Yeah.
And everything you say in there is, I mean, it happened.
Yeah.
But it was tough to relive it, to be honest with you. But it's interesting that I've talked to Cindy about this before. There's something about the age of 28, both you and Bridget hitting the age of 28. There seemed to be a switch that was flipped. Boom, I'm now an adult with some experience that I can use to help me.
Yeah.
Up until then, it was all a matter of making mistakes and gaining the experience. And that's the part that's hard for a parent to watch. And you know you got to go through it. But to sit back and allow your child to gain experience, and you don't gain experience by doing things right, to failing, but watching them get back up again, that's what life is about. It isn't about failure. It's about getting back up. And you did a lot of that. And then you use that experience to turn your life into something of purpose. And the same thing happened with Bridget at 28. So I don't know what it is about the age of 28. I think this conversation came up with Cindy and I because we were talking about her granddaughter, Caitlin, and about how she's changing and about how she's going to be when she's 28, you know, that kind of thing. But anyway, it's interesting. And then, have you share that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I turned 28 like 5 days after I had Lily. So, you know, it's and obviously becoming a parent changes a lot of things.
Big time.
So, well, I think I really like what you said about just the challenge, and that helps put things in perspective for me too. And I think too, like for people that listen to this, I think for both parents and children alike, it's that knowing that you have to watch a person you love make mistakes in order to grow, in order to change, in order to and even now with Lily and Amos being 10 and 8, like it's still hard because they're pushing boundaries and you want, John and I talk a lot about like we want Lily and Amos to make mistakes like in the safety of our home. You know what I mean? So that they have a soft place to land right now.
Well, exactly. Exactly. One of the things your mom and I used to talk about was we would do for you what you couldn't do for yourself. But when you could do it for yourself, you had to do it.
Yeah.
But we watched. We were careful with that. We were good stewards of that. We allowed you to fall down, but not to such a degree that it would scar you. But you could learn from it. And we helped you with those things, too. Occasionally, you would ask your mom a lot more questions than me. I mean, your mom got all the information. I got, fine. You'd come home from school, and I'd say, so how was your day? It was good. What'd you do? Oh, we did stuff. Would you have fun? I guess. Then your mom would walk in the room, and she'd say, hi, honey, how was your day? Oh, let me tell you. And then you'd go on for hours explaining your day. I asked her the same questions. And your mom would say, well, you didn't ask it right. I don't know. Anyway, you had that thing with your mom. But but you would. You would ask a question about something that might have happened. I remember with relationships with some of the little girls and things like that, you know.
Yeah.
But I wasn't privy to a lot of that. That was a you and a mom thing.
Yeah.
But the point is we let you learn. So you were prepared too in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Yeah, I was. And it's interesting, like, because when you were saying when you dropped me off at CNU and how, now looking back, I obviously completely know what you mean when you said, like, you didn't know which direction I was going to go. And it's interesting how my destructive choices, like, didn't necessarily become the destructive choices that you probably thought that there could be, if you know what I mean. Like, I didn't go to college and become, like, a crazy alcoholic drug addict partier. Like that wasn't the route. I didn't fail out of classes. It was more like other unhealthy choices that I was making in the long term.
Well, to tell you the truth, I kind of knew right away because of some of the phone calls. I remember one of your first phone calls, this is before the sorority thing.
Yeah.
Was you had this professor that you offered your opinion and you and he was told you that was wrong. And you said, wait a minute, it can't be wrong. It's just my opinion.
Yeah.
And you had a little battle with back and forth, wound up going to the dean over. I remember you sending, I remember looking at one of your papers, so you red marked all over the place, which was ridiculous. But you had this battle going back and forth. Long story short, he wasn't there the next semester, and you were. But that was the first thing that gave me, you know what, she's your mother's daughter. The next thing was, you know, you called and you said, Dad, I'm thinking about running for class office. What do you think about that? And I knew right there you had turned a corner, because you had never thought of anything like that before.
Yeah.
That was a real step out of your comfort zone. And
for
I
sure.
said, honey, go for it. And then came the sorority question. Do you think I should join a sorority? I'm thinking about doing that. I knew then you're off and running. You're on a good track. You still had a lot of life ahead of you, but you're at least on a good track.
Yeah. Well, I can say that your advice on rushing a fraternity was the best decision you made. I mean, I look back, I mean, obviously there was a lot that I loved about college, but I mean, still to this day, you know, some of my sorority sisters are people that I don't see them every day, but we talk, we text all the time. And then as soon as we see each other, we pick right back up. And I think a lot about that, about how I don't regret that for a moment. And I would do that over again, 100%.
Yeah.
Well, you obviously, we talked a lot about kind of your life up until you met Mom. And I, you know, I go into the whole story of how you and Mom actually met and in the book. But something I didn't go into in the book that I would love, and I've been actually thinking about this a lot. And I think this is one of those questions that now after the fact, I wish I'd asked. And because I don't think I've ever really asked you this question. Because on paper, when you look at the circumstances under which you and Mom met and got married and your early years of marriage, on paper, it makes no logical sense how you two survived, because, you know, you have both of you are recovering alcoholics. You're getting sober. Mom more newly so than you. You've both been married previously. You had a child from another marriage, and then you get married, and in 6 weeks after your first date, and then you have a child within a first year, and then you're nearly bankrupt, and then you like, I mean, it's on paper. It doesn't make sense, like how you guys not only survived, but I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I almost feel like thrived in your marriage, even though you were just immediately thrown into the lion's den of life. What was it? What was different about your marriage with Mom that set you both up for, again, I think kind of defeating, beating the what society, what statistics would say was like a marriage that was doomed from the start?
Yeah, let me give you a little, first, a previous history of that. It was quick, but that wasn't the original thought. First of all, the fact that I said to her, we're going to get married and have a daughter named Molly, I have no idea where that came from. That came from a place beyond my pay grade, okay? Was never on either one's radar screen, scared the heck out of her. But when we knew that we were going to get married, we had planned about a year later. And then something came up, I think maybe with her parents, they were going to be somewhere else. Anyway, so it kept moving it back. Oh, it'd be May. Then it's going to be February. Then, the next thing you know, well, the heck with it. We're both getting older. We wanted a daughter named Molly. We're going to get married as quick as we can. And that's what happened. The interesting thing was, it divided our AA friends. I mean, AA people are just as human as anybody else. And even though I had been out of a relationship for a long time, and your mom had been out of a previous relationship for a long time, people said, I must have been having an affair with your mom. Got her pregnant. That's why we're getting married. So we had people on one side who didn't buy any of that, and people on the other side who completely bought that, who didn't even talk to us, who actually shunned us. And what was funny about that is we never reacted to it. We thought, well, okay, they're going to turn their nose up at us, and that's just what they're going to do. We knew it wasn't true, and so it didn't matter to us. The funny thing about it was the following May, I was chairman of a speaker meeting, and so I go, and your mom was still out in the parking lot talking to people, pregnant while they're here. And I'm up at setting up the meeting, and some people on the side that bought the affair thing are saying, we knew it. Linda had her baby. Her sister was in a meeting today and told how her sister had a child, was born. Well, it turned out her sister Mary was in a meeting and was talking about Sue having Dane. But so all this buzz was going on in the pre-meeting while your mom is still out in the parking lot. And I'm thinking to myself, wait till they see her walk in, pregnant out there here. This ought to be good. So, and that's what happened. Mouths dropped, you know. Of course, then you were born in August. But your mom and I had a real good laugh over that one. Anyway, where the heck was I going with that? Oh, yeah. I think what we did, number one, we had respect for each other's programs. I didn't try to get in her program. She didn't try to get in mine. We shared what was in common like that. We both cherished the fact that we had a spiritual program by which we could live by and grow by. AA not only has 12 steps, it has 12 traditions. The traditions are there to govern how AA groups function. And we decided that that's how we were going to operate our marriage. And we just translated the 12 traditions into language that applied to our marriage. And that it worked. It worked. They're just universal principles. It eliminates.
Can you say what some of those things were that you guys did?
Right. Like I might have an agenda. She might have an agenda. But what's out of both those agendas, what's best for the whole? What's best for the family would come the final decision kind of thing. Each person within the family was autonomous, yet each function of the family member was to operate for the good of the whole. That no one was more important than the other. We all worked together. And, you know, I could go on, like I say, there's 12 traditions, but that worked best. That worked best. We just never had any problem. We never fought. Although there was, you know, your mom played golf. You know how she got into it? Yeah.
Oh, I know how she got it. But yes, you should tell this story because I don't tell this story in the book.
You were bottle fed. You were breastfed, rather. And she would pump. So we have breast milk in the refrigerator. And you're still at the breastfed stage. And we got into. Now, we're not married that long. I mean, we're married that long, but you haven't been around that long. And we got into a political argument. And I said something really stupid, like, you don't know what you're talking about.
For people that don't know, my parents were on opposite ends of the political spectrum. Let's just say that.
Yeah, absolutely. And you just don't say that to Linda Vandeman or Buckley. Okay. So that's what I said. She said, really? And she handed you to me. And said, I'll see you. And out the door she went. This was a Friday. I had no idea where she was going. And she didn't come home. And she didn't come home Saturday. And late Sunday, she pulls in the driveway. Meanwhile, I've had for 48 hours a bottle-fed baby. And I don't have the body for it. So I'm trying to get you to take a bottle. And you're not having any of that. So it was not... It was not a pleasant weekend. Let me put it that way. Your mother comes through the door and I said, I'm sorry. I'll never say anything like that again. Where the hell you been? Well, I showed you. I went to your favorite golf course, to Capon State Park in West Virginia, and I took some golf lessons. And tomorrow, you're taking me to the golf store and buying me clubs. Because I'm going to start playing golf. Well, the next day, Monday, I took her to Golf Galaxy or wherever the heck golf store was at the time. But Washington Golf. It was at Washington Golf.
I remember Washington Golf. Yeah.
Yeah. And it cost me $1,200 that weekend. We had a bag. We had shoes. We had clubs. We had balls. We had the whole shebang. And yeah, it was a $1,200 weekend there. But it, you know, turned out to be a great thing. We did a lot of that. We did a lot of that together. Took those trips on the motorhome, golf trips, things like that. So it turned out to be a wonderful thing. But I learned a big lesson there too. I wasn't living up to one of those principles. I had to be right. Well, no, being right's not important. You know, the good of the whole is important.
Yeah. Well, that reminds me of another political story of the two of you in the year 2000. Do you know what I'm referencing?
I do. Oh, God.
Can you tell this story?
Yeah, it's the Clinton-Bush era.
Mm-hmm.
And your mom was bedridden at election time. And she called me in the room and she said, in this hard-to-speak voice, she said, "Honey, I need a big favor from you." And I said, "What's that?" She said, "Don't vote today." She asked me not to vote because she couldn't cancel my vote out. So, that's a lot of shit. I said, "Okay," and I didn't vote. Didn't vote.
Well, and that's like another thing to add to that whole layer of just on paper. It made no sense why you two worked the way you did. I mean, not only did you start your marriage with all of that, just, you know, a smorgasbord of life. Yeah. And then you're, you know, complete opposite ends of the political spectrum. And then mom gets sick and it just, you know, all of the things that on paper destroy a marriage, somehow the two of you had the frame of mind you allowed it to strengthen.
Well, you know, one thing we learned early on is when you're making a list of priorities, God has to be first in some way. Yeah. Everything else follows after that. If you put in our case, it was not drinking had to be first. That had to be number one. There's a saying also in AA, anything you put before not drinking, you will lose. After that, it became easy to list the things that were absolutely important. And you know what? Political stuff isn't important.
Yeah.
Opinions aren't that important. But the love and respect of one another is important. Kindness with one another is important. Fulfilling your responsibilities is important. Those things are important. The things you can't really touch, you know. And they don't come from outside stuff. They come from within, and that from within is given. That's a gift that is given, again, from beyond my pay grade.
Yeah.
But that's how we live. That's how we live today. So I live with Cindy.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. I've been blessed twice in my life. Cindy and I feel the same way. Yeah, I think Cindy and your mother could have been sisters, to be honest with you. But it's that kind of thing. You have the things you like, that's fine. And I have the things I like, that's fine. And we appreciate that. We have our differences in those ways, but they aren't the most important thing in the relationship. They're not the most important thing in the world, but we show love and respect for one another. That is after not drinking.
Yeah. So, I mean, after I submitted my manuscript, I came up with the title because the title I'd had on the manuscript when I originally submitted it was not this. And it's interesting how I think back to childhood, and especially like after mom got sick, I remember like there are things I remember just about how you and mom navigated this really heavy stuff. Obviously, I tell the story of the Grotto of Lourdes in the book, but there are other stories like that where you guys, in what was, you know, really a hard time, you know, carrying a lot of really heavy emotional things, it's not that you were deflecting. It was that you chose in the moment to not focus on the negativity of the circumstances, but to look for the good. And I know that you and I had a lot of conversations around how important mom's joy and mom's peace was and how protective of that you were, because you saw a direct correlation to how it affected her health. But it's interesting how after the fact, I'm now realizing that so much of that, if I don't laugh, I'll cry mantra, I really got from you guys, and how I learned what it was like. I learned, you know, on my own, I learned a lot of unhealthy ways to use humor as a coping mechanism. But in a lot of ways, I learned from you how laughter and humor were a healing part of the pain in your journey. Was that something that you and mom did consciously, or do you think it was just your unique personalities?
Both, but it was a conscious effort.
Did you have conversations about this?
Oh yeah, call it rule 62. Don't take yourself too seriously. Focus on what's important. And you know, there's another saying we have in AA: you want to see who the winners are, follow the laughter. It's one of those things you learn. You don't regret the past, but you learn from it and appreciate what it did in terms of bringing you to wherever you are in life. So a lot of that negative baggage is shed. And if you don't take, it's not that you don't take other things serious. There are things in life that certainly need to be taken seriously. But if you take yourself too seriously, you just lose sight of all the things that really are important. I know it sounds like repetitive, but that's a fact. It just is. And I'm not that important. You know, I'm nothing special. I'm a human being, just like any other human being, is trying to do the best they can. And when I keep myself in that perspective, I stay right-sized and everything else around me seems to work okay. If I get out of that, then I'm something more than I am, and I'm some sort of worth some sort of serious take. Well, no, that's not going to lead me anywhere positive, you know. And when you're dealing with stuff like a serious illness or a serious loss, you've got to find some humor in it, or you can't get through it. You know, wind up biting the bullet or something. It's not worth it, because you've got to, in the getting through it stage, you gain experience and knowledge that you can use to get out of it. You can find places for help and guidance that will work. If you don't do that, you can't find those places. You don't get any help and guidance, and you wind up just getting deeper in that pit. So that's the opposite of not laughing about it. So yeah, it was part of our personality, but it's also a conscious thing.
I remembered a story, and I don't know if you remember this or not, but it occurred to me the other day, and it was a reminder of, so I want to say mom was in ICU, you know, she's hooked up to a bunch of machines, a bunch of tubes, like we're in the hospital room with her. And, you know, it's just a somber, like everybody's just kind of sad and somber. And I remember the nurse had come in to change her IV bag. And I don't know if you were sitting next to her at the end of the bed or whatever, but I'm sitting there, I'm holding her hand. The nurse comes in, she changes the IV bag. And the second she unplugs it, mom does the fish face inspired by the little girl in Airplane when the nurse like knocks the IV bag loose. Yeah. in that scene in the movie Airplane. Do you remember what I'm talking about? Do you remember this story?
I do, yeah. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. And mom's like laying there in the bed in ICU. She's doing the like.
Yeah. Pretending she's going. Yeah. Yeah.
And like the nurse is immediately almost like horrified. And we all just like bust out laughing. And it just, I remember like it took the temperature of the room from, you know, it cooled everybody off. It wasn't until later that I was thinking about that memory, and I was like, that right there was like a microcosm of I feel like how mom's perspective on the illness and just her whole like, it's way too serious in here, guys. Like, I'm going to do my part to make y'all lighten up.
Like, yeah.
Oh man. So obviously that brings us to where you are today. Obviously the light of a lot of light.
I got to ask one question.
You can ask any question.
This picture, is that your third grade preschool yearbook picture?
Third grade preschool yearbook
picture? I mean, you're 3 years old. Your first year of preschool, you're 3 years old.
No.
I'm trying to remember where that picture was. I remember the picture.
Yeah. No, the picture on the front, it was, so it was in a frame on mom's dresser for a long time.
Oh, yeah.
I'm probably only like three or four in it.
I thought you were three, and that was like a preschool photo op or something.
No, it was because I have the original, and the original just like is like, you know, a standard 4x6, and it was in a frame, and it just says like unserious Molly or something like that on the back. And I mean, it's just like, there's no like, when was this? What was the context? I don't know if it was like mom wanted to take a picture of me and I was just like, hard pass. So I'm going to make this face. But I know that the face, I'm not making it consciously. It's just like she clearly wanted to take a picture of me and I was not having it. But what I love about it so much is you don't know. You can't tell, like, am I about to bust out laughing? Am I about to start crying? Am I really mad? It's anything is possible.
Yeah, I thought you had gas.
Oh my gosh. Well, is there anything? Okay. Well, I guess there was one other thing I was going to say. Is there any question or anything in the book that, I don't know, that you have a question about that surprised you, that, I don't know, anything you want to share or ask?
No, nothing surprised me. I was very happy for you on a couple of things. The gals at the bank that helped you, things like that. The, meeting John and all that stuff I was privy to. I was in Northern Virginia when he proposed, but I listened on the radio because he gave me a heads up. I mean, all that stuff was, nothing surprised me.
Yeah.
I'm just proud of how you let life experience give you life, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Thanks, Dad. Did you have a favorite part? A part that made you laugh out loud? Was there any chapters that made you laugh?
The Lord's chapter, of course.
Yeah.
That was a trip. I mean, that I'll always laugh at that one.
Yeah.
So that was probably the best. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a fun one. It's a pretty classic memory. Yeah. So obviously a lot of life has happened. And you've mentioned her, but, you do have another love of your life, in Cindy, and now you're living the retired life. And as we conclude here, you know, now that you are approaching 80 years old, I think 80 is awesome.
Months.
So as you look back on your life, and especially as you approach a milestone birthday, what advice do you have for the people listening who are not about to turn 80 years old? What's some of the like best life advice you've learned over the years that like your like wisdom you would like to impart?
Two words: slow down. Life happens fast enough. Slow down. Appreciate what you have in the moment.
Is there anything that you, I mean, I know, I love what you said about you don't regret anything because everything that you did, even the hard stuff, has led you to where you are now. But is there anything in particular where you wish you'd slowed down a little bit more?
Oh, gosh, yes. Time with my parents. Do I wish I would ask my dad more questions, my mom more questions? Do I wish I would have been more present during my mom's illness?
Yeah.
I was way too centered on me and what was going on with me and what I was doing in life. Yeah, but no. Would definitely do that different. But I was moving too fast to see that, you know? Too self-centered.
Yeah.
When you go too fast, that's what happens. Slow down. But I think that could be said anywhere. For the longest, when I say longest time, most of my life, instant gratification wasn't fast enough. It's not that way anymore. But some lessons come late, but at least they come, you know?
Yeah.
So above anything else, that's what I would say. Slow down.
That's good advice. That's good advice, Dad. Well, you've been my most recalcitrant guest, but
I'm going to be 80. You're going to have a father who's 80.
I know. Gosh, makes me seem old.
I got more nooks and crannies than a Thomas English muffin. It's getting ridiculous.
Oh, my gosh.
So I'm still moving.
You're still
getting
moving.
Up and down.
Yeah, still living that retired life. And
I'm blessed. Yeah. I'm blessed. I've got a life partner that's unbelievable. And, you know, I got to say this. You know, back early on when I was saying let go and let God, when I get out of my own way, things happen that are good for me. And Cindy's another example of that. I wasn't looking, and she lived too far away. But the moment I saw her, I came to Durham to meet her at a restaurant for breakfast one morning. And the moment I saw her walk up that sidewalk, I said, I know this woman. I know this woman. And it's been like that ever since. And she says we're a gift to one another, but she's definitely a gift to me. So I couldn't be happier.
Well, she's a gift to me too. And to our kids, they love their Nana.
They do. Well, she's a cool Nana.
She is a cool Nana. The coolest of Nanas.
I'll
yeah.
tell you,
those kids, they love that Nana. They also love that Pop-Pop.
Well, the thing is, Cindy's wacky enough to be part of this family.
Yeah, it's true. It's true.
I mean, she's a unique individual. You're not going to find another Cindy walking around. She can say... She has words in her vocabulary your mother had that she can use for nouns, verbs, pronouns, the whole bit. It's amazing. Maybe it's a nurse thing. Maybe I have a thing for nurses. I don't know.
I think so.
But this particular kind of nurse. And she wrote a book. So good figure that. Three women in my life wrote books.
I know. Look at that. What are the odds?
I know. Slim and none. But they worked. Because somebody's working in our lives.
That's right. That's right. Dad, thanks for being my guest. Thanks for reading my book. Thanks for liking it. And thanks for telling your stories.
I'd say thanks for having me because it's always good being had.
I love you, Dad.
I love you too, baby. Talk to you later.
I hope you loved this conversation with my dad. Is he not the best? I'm not going to have his social media links because, you know, he's almost 80. And so he doesn't really use social media. But I really hope that you love this episode. And I would love to know what you loved. If there was anything in particular, would you let me know on social media? You can find me at Still Being Molly or at Can I Laugh Pod, wherever you get your podcasts or your social medias. And would you head on over to your favorite app that you are listening or watching this podcast on, and would you click that subscribe or follow button? That way you never miss a new episode of the show. And yes, I have mentioned this a couple times, but we do have all of these podcasts available on YouTube now. So you can watch the interviews if you like to watch podcasts that way, but also you can access it on whatever podcast platform you like listening to. So thank you so much for your support. Thank you for tuning in and week out. Thank you to the team at Third Wheel Media for doing the production of the show. And for you, something this week, I hope it makes you laugh till you cry. We'll see you next week. Bye.